No shortage of things to talk about this Monday afternoon. Lydia Ko won her Olympic gold medal and achieved something even more difficult in the process. She got into the LPGA Tour's Hall of Fame, but will this be the mic drop moment of her career? And over on the PGA Tour, Aaron Rye has been having a sneaky good season, but there's nothing sneaky about it now. The Englishman, famous for his two gloves and iron covers, is a PGA Tour winner after claiming the Wyndham Championship. And that win became official today because the PGA Tour's regular season extended by one day because of one man, this guy. Matt Kuchar just had the most talked about tie for 12th in the history of the tour. We dive into all of that. Golf Today starts now.
Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside Jordan Cornett. And Jordan, just when everyone thought there wouldn't be much sporting excitement to talk about after the closing ceremony in Paris, Matt Kuchar says, hold my Beaujolais.
Look, if you said we're going to take this Wyndham Championship into Monday, it'd be to crown a champion, right, is what you would have expected, and not much drama to it. But it was exactly the opposite, wasn't it, here?
Well, officially we crowned a champion today, but at least no one was forced to wait until Matt Kuchar finished playing the 18th hole.
But people were forced to work on Monday, and we'll get a little bit to that here shortly. On Sunday night in Greensboro, though, it was Aaron Rye who was victorious in the Wyndham Championship, the last PGA Tour event of the regular season. Rye closed with a final round, 664, with a birdie at the last to post 18 under par. That win for Aaron is his first career victory on the PGA Tour. The victory moves him from 53rd all the way to 25th in the FedEx Cup standings, putting him in great position to make the Tour Championship at Eastlake in just a few weeks as we take a look at that leaderboard. In case you missed it, though, you have to see what happened last night on 18th. That mention of Matt Kuchar, well, here it is. Chasing dusk on the 18th in that final group with Ramy and Greizerman. Inexplicably, and still no real clarity on why Kuch elected to hit into the group in front of him with the leader who had all but cemented the championship in Aaron Rye. And from there, it would get even more confounding, Eamon.
Well, you saw Roots official drive by there who did actually tell the group that they could stop playing if they chose. And that's what Matt Kuchar decided to do. He said he was not going to finish the hole. His playing partners decided that they would finish out the 18th.
And so that's exactly what he would do today. Officials, get back out there. Kuch is going to go ahead and finish his round. The motivating factors, to be quite honest, are still up in the air, despite the fact that he did make comments today. You'll hear those shortly. He would hit a nice approach shot, which would have him not putting quite yet, but chipping on his third shot here. And the third shot, look, as if this couldn't get more entertaining with the highs and lows, he almost chips it for birdie.
He did get some relief from a scoreboard in his way, but all those Twitter trolls who said he had zero chance of making a birdie, that was for birdie. And this, a tap in for par.
Does tap in for par. It does have financial implications and also exemption implications. Here's Kuch after he finishes round Monday morning.
First off, how cool would that have been if it went in?
Listen, nobody wants to be that guy, which I've clearly turned into, the one guy that didn't finish. I can't tell you how many times I have been finished with a round thinking, bummed out that somebody didn't finish, that we didn't get to make the cut because somebody didn't finish. And here it's me now as the guy that didn't get to finish the tournament. I can't tell you how many times I've been so happy to have just finished. Round two, we had Gary Woodland run to the ninth tee to hit a final shot to be able to let us finish round two. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've wanted to finish, how many times I've been bummed to have one or two holes left. But last night was dark. I mean, we had texts that round one was suspended at 8:15, round two was suspended at 8:25. That was to make the cut, so they pushed it even longer. Last night, round four was suspended at 8:40. Like, it was dark. I think had I had been in the fairway with a normal shot, I probably would have attempted to finish. But I had just seen Max four putt the 16th hole. If there was daylight on that green, does he four putt? I don't know. But I just watched something happen. I had a putt three holes prior, 13th hole. I mean, decent daylight, no daylight on the green, color, totally covered in shade. Missed a five-footer. Like, I'm thinking, it's hard to putt. The general rule of thumb, I don't know if you guys rule of thumb when you're playing, you try to hit a tee shot if you can hit a tee shot. If you've got a reasonable approach, you hit it, you putt in the morning. You mark it, you wait if you have any sort of important putt. I did not realize Aaron Rye had made birdie on the last. So I'm over in 10 trying to figure out what I'm going to do. I'm figuring no way Max is going to finish out with a chance to win a tournament. I thought Max for sure had a shot to win, and I thought, no way in this situation do you hit this shot. You come back in the morning 100% of the time. And so I said, well, Max will stop, I'll stop, kind of make it easy on him. And for me, coming back in the morning, like, I never would have taken that drop last night. I never would have thought to ask. I would have had a, I knew I was in a terrible situation. I was praying to make bogey from where I was. To walk away with par, nearly birdie, is a huge bonus. I mean, it again, it stinks to, nobody wants to be that guy that's showing up today, one person, one hole, not even one hole, half a hole to play. So apologies to the tournament, to everybody that had to come out. Like, I know it stinks. I know the ramifications. I know it stinks. But certainly I apologize to force everybody to come out here.
What went into the decision to hit the tee shot on 18?
That was, again, the rule of thumb. You try to. And I literally thought, as we're putting on 16, I thought, all right, I'm first to hit. I'll go to 17, be ready to hit, expecting a siren at that time. It had to be 8:20 at that time on 17 tee. Thinking, man, you know, I could maybe do what Gary Woodland did for our target, allow the group to play 17. I know the rules officials are trying to, everybody wants to get done. Nobody wants to be that. We all want to get done. So yeah, you hit the tee shot and kind of decide from there. And I mean, you guys saw the predicament I was in. It was a horrible place. Had it been a standard shot, I most likely would have proceeded.
Did you see the guys in the fairway when you hit on 18?
No, I mean, clearly I was not hitting to hit just to push. I thought I was on the tee. There was a guy in pink walking on the green. I assumed it was Billy Horschel. There was a pink shirt walking on the back of the green. I assumed they were already up there. And they were not.
12 hours later, would you do anything different?
From that situation? No. Listen, I would have been so pleased with a bogey last night. All I was thinking was, let's try to avoid double this morning. And then to come out and have, you know, the ability to take a drop, to get relief is a bonus. I just hope it doesn't cause too many problems. I was excited that at least they got Aaron Rye, got to finish, got to do the awards ceremony. I think that would have really stunk if had Aaron not cemented the win and been able to do the trophy ceremony and all that goes with it.
What kind of reaction have you heard in the last 12 hours, seen, dealt with?
Not thankfully I avoid that stuff. I did get a call from my agent, said, hey, you're causing quite a stir. So that was the little I heard. I am grateful to not be a part of the social media thing.
All right, we heard from Matt Kuchar. Let's hear from PGA Tour Communications. The final round of the Wyndham Championship resumed at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and then very shortly after, the Wyndham Championship was completed at 8:06. Matt Kuchar makes par at number 18 and finishes T12.
The pace of play was like that every week.
Yes, exactly that. Look, Eamon, I've gotten to know you a little bit over these last few months, and when I saw your tweet last night and your stance, amidst all the confusion, I found myself even more confused. I didn't have you taking the stance on this Kuch situation that you did. Elaborate, please.
But, you know, Kuch is an easy target for the firing squads on social media out there, but everyone's acting as though he had no skin in the game, which is absurd. He did have skin in the game. He wasn't going to make the playoffs. He wasn't going to win the golf tournament. But finishing where he did, finishing in that tie for 12th, leaves him finishing 103rd in the FedEx Cup standings. He's heading into the fall needing to stay within the one top 125
to remain
tour card.
Yep.
And for next season. So he did actually have skin in the game, and he impacted nobody by stopping play except himself. He didn't impact anyway. Aaron Rye didn't have to wait around until this morning to get his trophy. Nobody else was impacted at all, other than a few tour officials who had to show up, and that really comes with a job, because no army of volunteers was going out there. The fans weren't going out there. These courses are busy in the day after tour events anyway, with fender outings, with corporate stuff going on, with teardowns. Nobody was really, a mass of people were not forced to be there simply because Matt Kuchar didn't want to play.
Eamon, that's where I disagree with you. I do think it impacted some people. I think there was a lack of awareness of exactly who it impacted. Think about the weekend that was. Could decisions have been made differently by Wyndham Championship and officials to push to Monday so they didn't have to play 36 holes on Sunday? Absolutely. But was there a grind of an effort to bypass the weather and get this thing completed and all the hours that went into it for one guy to sit there and say, I'm going to come back out Monday, never truly saying, because we never heard from Cooch, what his motivating factor was. There was a lot of filibustering going on there. Different take when he spoke to our Todd Lewis, who did a great job getting the initial report, to what he said today. It seemed disingenuous to me. This was a man who understood what it took to play this tournament, what it took to get to this point, and I feel like he never truly said in any of the sound we heard from him or the reports what his motivating factor was. At one point, he said he wanted to teach Max, he wanted to set the example for Max.
Max it's just 20, not his business.
Max is 29 years old. Yeah. He doesn't need an example to be set. And as we fight a narrative in this sport about, you know, arrogance or pompous or caring about money and all these things, this doesn't do it the service that we would like. This is not the narrative we want coming out of this weekend. It should be the officials fought hard to make this thing happen, no matter how you feel about how it should be played, and Aaron Rye being crowned champion. But what are we talking about first? Well, and that's what I don't like.
Who's the villain here? I mean, this is a big week because since we went from the top 125 keeping their cards and making the playoffs to the top 70 making the playoffs, this week is enormous. And the PGA Tour needs to put a spotlight on the enormous weeks. And guys are playing for a livelihood out there, but they choose to have 36 holes of guys running against the clock. Why?
Now that,
why did they need to finish
yesterday?
It's a nonsense. They created this situation and put Matt Kuchar and everyone else in that situation. The PGA Tour is the villain here for trying to squeeze in a tournament that didn't need to be squeezed in. It could have finished this morning, even if they were playing nine holes.
I just don't like the 11th hour stance, picking up your ball on your second shot at that point.
Well, he had been told by the entire group, was told walking off the 18th tee by a rules official that they had the option to stop if they wished to stop. He made a decision to stop. That was not impacting anyone else. And, you know, Aaron Rye, Max Griezmann, they're not Matt Kuchar's problem. He had his own skin in the game.
Which is why he should have made the comments about setting the example.
They got to make the decision, but he did not impact them in any respect. He got to make the decision that he thought was right for him. They got to make the decision that was right for them. I think it's a bit of a storm in a teacup simply because Kuchar is an easy target for the trolls.
And I agree with that. And look, and I'll talk out of both sides of my mouth with this part. Look, we're looking for some storylines. We're looking for some heat within the tour.
He delivered.
I mean, maybe Kuch delivered that because here we are talking about some drama, which is always good for any sport, most especially golf. But I will go back to clarity. Communicate what you're really feeling. If that was his stance, I would have loved to hear that from Kuch that night. He could have come out with it, whether he's on social media or not. He could have presented that case, and he could have done it more clearly here. He never said, hey, look, money was involved in this. My card was involved in this. I didn't like how this tournament was run and the decisions being made. He's pretty candid with certain points, but it always seemed to waver. Like, what was your true motivating decision behind all this? And I still sit here today unsure and uncertain of what Matt was thinking.
I don't buy the whole point that he wanted to set an example for Max Griezmann. It's not his place to do that. Max can make his own decision, but he hit the tee shot because no one had sounded a siren. And until the siren goes off and the horn goes off, these guys are conditioned to think that the tournament is ongoing. It wasn't until they walked off the 18th tee that Matt Kuchar was told, all of you guys have the individual choice to stop. He was the one who stopped because he thought it was the best for the position that he found himself in. I don't see that it impacted anyone else. But you know what we did actually have yesterday? In all this conversation about Matt Kuchar, he didn't actually win the tournament. We did have a winner yesterday. Let's hear what Aaron Rye had to say afterwards.
And I'm with the champion. And Aaron, I want to go back to when you were standing on the 14th tee and Max holed out for eagle. The deficit at that point was 4 for you. What were you thinking as you were about to tee off and play these final holes?
I wasn't really aware of the situation. Obviously saw that Max had held out. We were on the tee box when he hit that shot. I just really tried to play as well as I could coming in, and I felt if I did that, then I'd give myself a chance. What Max was doing was, as cliche as it sounds, was out of my control. And felt like I did a really good job there on the last few holes of just staying pretty present and some good shots and having some chances there coming in.
And after that hole out eagle, though, Max does make a quadruple bogey, and suddenly you're in the mix to win this. When did you find out about that? Were you watching the leaderboard at all? And once you got that information, did anything in your mind change?
Not particularly. I wanted to know what the situation was coming down 18. Billy mentioned something to me, Horshaw. Jason, again, just said focus on playing a good hole. So I think that was a message internally. That was a message from Jason as well, just to really focus on what we were doing. We were playing a lot of good golf to even be in that situation. And to just keep going through till the end, keep trying to focus on playing some good shots, making smart decisions, and see where that puts us at the end of it.
Over the last month and a half, you've put yourself in positions to win on the PGA Tour. We talked about this yesterday and how much that may give you more comfort down the stretch if you have an opportunity to win again. Did you feel comfortable today?
Yeah, I think all of those experiences are extremely valuable. It didn't mean that necessarily today was going to go really well. It didn't mean I was going to handle the situation today well, but there were definitely a few things that I'd done well over recent weeks in that situation and things that I could have done better, and felt like I did a really good job today at staying very present, very patient, and very focused, and luckily things fell our way today.
Finally, Aaron, you grew up fairly modestly in England. You made your way to the DP World Tour, where you won there. You come to the PGA Tour, and now you're a PGA Tour winner. How emotionally impactful is that for you to have this dream come true?
It's phenomenal. I think it probably hasn't sunk in just yet. It really is a dream come true, and it's an extremely long journey to even get to this point. So to win an event out here, to win the Wyndham Championship, which is a fantastic event. I would have grown up watching it. So it's extremely special.
Congratulations, Aaron Rye, the champion here in Greensboro.
Here's another look at that final round leaderboard from Greensboro, a final round of 64 by Aaron Rye for that two-stroke victory over Max Gracerman. Well, winning an Olympic medal is usually the toughest accomplishment in any sport. For Lydia Ko, that medal earned her a place in the toughest Hall of Fame in golf. But will this be the final chapter in a storied career? We're going to take a look at her journey coming up next.
Golf Today, brought to you by Bushnell Golf and the new Pro X3. The best just got even better. Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Lydia Ko made history over the weekend, winning a gold medal in the Paris Olympic Games. It was her third medal overall. She's got the full set, gold, silver, bronze. And with the win, she qualified for the LPGA Tour's Hall of Fame. Well, let's take a look back at Lydia Ko's journey to the Hall of Fame. Short in years, but celebrated. 2012, as a 15-year-old, she won the US Women's Amateur, becoming the second youngest player to win that title. She defeated J. Marie Green 3-1 in the final at the Country Club. And just 2 weeks later, she won again as an amateur, but this time against the professionals. She took home the Canadian Women's Open on the LPGA Tour, went on to defend that title the following year.
Aiming at her first major championship, go back to 2015, the Amundi Evian Championship. She beat the field by 6 strokes, shooting a final round 8-under-63. With that win, she would become the youngest major champion in LPGA Tour history at the age of 18 years, 4 months, and 20 days old. That following year, Lydia wasn't done. She won a major championship number 2. She had to rally in the final round with a birdie on the 72nd hole to win by 1 shot in the Chevron Championship over Charlie Hole and NG Chun. With this win, Lydia became the youngest 2-time major champion in LPGA Tour history.
A little more recently, she capped off a 3-win season back in 2022. That's the trophy from the CME Group Tour Championship, the season-ending event. And here's how the math works for the LPGA Tour's Hall of Fame. It's a points-based system. You need 27 points. It adds up with 2 majors, 18 LPGA Tour victories, a Player of the Year award twice, a Vera Trophy winner twice, and that last point with the Olympic gold medal that puts her over the finishing line into the toughest Hall of Fame ever. And Lydia said a few years ago, Jordan, that she wasn't going to be playing at 30. She would walk by then. She's 27 years old now. I assume she's sticking to that because she just said this would be her last game. So she's not planning to be in LA as a 31-year-old, it would seem. But a lot of folks thought that she would walk away. Does a mic drop moment get better than this? You make the toughest Hall of Fame with a gold medal?
Yeah. You know, for me, Eamon, I think about Michael Jordan. And I know you're not a basketball guy, so I'll be quick here. The crossover against the Utah Jazz on Byron Russell. And everyone thought that moment when he hit that shot, we'd never see Michael Jordan play basketball again. We never saw him play in a Bulls jersey. That was it. That was the mic drop moment for the Bulls. But then he went on and played for the Wizards, and it just looked different. Now, you don't have that in golf, so you don't have to worry about that with Lydia Ko. I hope for her exit is what she wants it to be. And this is a pretty incredible spot to have it. At 27th point, you've notched your place in the LPGA Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
You've now done the Olympic Slam. And an Olympic Slam is a term never been used in golf on the male or female side. She's won gold. She's won silver. She's won bronze, capping it off with this gold. And to me, this is what the Olympics are about. Greatness, world greatness. I wrote down a list of some of them who thrived in the Paris Olympics and why I believe they're the best Olympics of all time. You got Simone Biles, Steph Curry, LeBron James, Katie Ledecky, Noah Lyles, Cindy McLaughlin, and Lydia Ko representing her country and doing it with what's on the line. There's no better finish in this. And when you say she's 27 years old, I'm like, wow, think about the life she's lived in front of us as a teenage phenom to now.
Yeah, she was, go back 10 years ago when she was just 17, she made Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world at that point. But if you want to put it in golf terms, I tend to agree with you that the best mic drop moment you can get is getting into the toughest Hall of Fame in all of sports.
All of sports.
And to do that on the Olympic podium. But if you're a golf nerd, there is a better mic drop moment, and it's coming up in a couple of weeks. If she were to win the AIG Women's Open and do walk off from the 18th green at the Old Course, all of the greats.
Yeah, that is pretty good.
Jack left there, Arnie left there. It's pretty good company.
Yeah, I guess I just think about, we didn't know if Lydia was going to make this impossible Hall of Fame. Like, we didn't know if that final point was going to elude her. So I guess that's why, of course, you make a great point with AIG. But to me, it's just, you're watching class personified. How she won, her embrace with her sister, who's been with her every step of the way. There's so many cool things to watch in how it was a storybook. She even mentioned it was this mythical ending. She's keenly aware of what she's achieved. And I also know, hearing from her, Lexi, we're unsure what Lexi's going to do. It seemed finite, at least. There's not going to be four-year runway with Lydia. There's not going to be a 2028 Olympics for her. So the fact that she was able to cap off all those medals, do it with a gold, to cement her place in the Hall of Fame, pretty special.
And I also think it proves, and the Scottie Scheffler at the Olympics proved the same thing, that it's easy for naysayers to say, well, a gold medal will only ever be the fifth biggest prize in the sport, which is limited thinking because it was never intended to be an instead of or a versus major championship. It's additive to the process. It's another great trophy for golfers to have. Novak Djokovic had won everything in the sport. He didn't look upset by winning the gold medal out there. He actually said it was one of the greatest moments of his career. And I think what it proved is golf finally got its footing in the Olympics this year, which Zika in Rio and COVID in Tokyo had kind of cost it a lot over the years. But it's more about golf claiming a place among this global community of sports and stop being this kind of insular country club thinking that sometimes affects the sport. And to me, this felt like the Olympics where golf finally actually took its rightful place there.
Couldn't have said it any better myself, my friend. It was absolutely incredible to watch class personified in Lydia Ko notch her place in golf immortality. And maybe, like you said, still some work to be done with Lydia Ko, which is pretty cool. When Golf Today returns, we're bringing together a special roundtable of writers to talk all things LPGA. We recap some of the biggest stories in the women's game, including what's next for the Hall of Famer Lydia Ko. Beth Ann Nichols and Ron Syrak, they join us next.
Time now for Golf Today Roundtable, as we welcome in Golf Channel's contributor Ron Syrak and Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols. Beth Ann, I want to start with you. Obviously a remarkable weekend for Lydia Ko, and it's hard to imagine a bigger mic drop opportunity for Lydia Ko to make it into the toughest Hall of Fame in all of sport and to do so with an Olympic medal. She did say she's playing Scotland. She's going to play the Scottish Open this week. She's going to play the AIG Women's Open after that. Do we see her in 2025?
I would be more surprised to see her in 2025 than to not see her, if I'm honest. You know, I think at this point, you know, she's done pretty much everything she wants to do. And I think that, you know, she wants to enjoy married life. I don't think she was a player that was going to stick around to wait for that elusive final point. So now that she's got it and she's actually in the Hall of Fame, I definitely think her next chapter will come sooner rather than later. But she told me late last year, after having one of the most difficult years of her career, she said, you know, one thing I know for certain is that I don't want to start this next chapter without having a plan, because the last thing I want to do is feel lost, because this is all she's known her entire life. So I find that, you know, to be extremely wise in what you'd expect from Lydia Ko, to want to have her ducks in a row.
You know, and I'm absolutely sure she does have a plan. I mean, we saw in that interview with her, she's an incredibly smart woman. She thinks down the road. She knows where this is going to go. I don't know if anybody's ever accomplished as much on one day as she did. Gold medal, Olympic triple crown, LPGA Hall of Fame. Only athlete, golfer, male or female, to win medals in all three of the Olympic Games made. There's nothing really else for her to accomplish. And she's been teasing us for a long time that she's out of here at 30. And I'm leaning that's the way it's going to go.
Ron, you make a great point. I truly don't know who achieved more in one day than Lydia Ko did. And it really resonated with me, the comment Beth Ann just made in her reports and talking to Lydia, that this is all she's known. I mean, Lydia's whole career has played out in front of us, from a teenage phenom to now cementing her legacy forever as a Hall of Famer. So, Ron, as you look back on this career that is still ongoing, no question, what has impressed you most with all the achievements from Lydia throughout?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a while, and some of them are still there. Any record that began with the word youngest ended with the words Lydia Ko, you know, youngest to get to top number one in Rolex rankings, everything. So it was all there. But you know what really impresses me? She had about a 3-year lull. You know, she, after that incredible run through her teenage years, she tried to mess with her swing a little bit, try to get a little longer, tried to turn the ball over, and she sort of lost her mojo on the golf course. And the fact, over these last 2 or 3 years, she's fought herself back to this stage, probably impresses me even more than all those incredible accomplishments in her teenage years.
Beth Ann, there were two other players on that podium, obviously, and a lot of great stories during the course of the week in Paris. What was your favorite takeaway from watching the women's golf in the Olympics for the third time?
Well, outside of Lydia Ko on that podium, definitely Maria Ho-Uribe. You know, I don't think we can talk enough about what it means to be an LPGA mom and to wear both of those hats. And this is a player who plays with so much emotion. She's so fun to watch. And she boldly put it out there that, you know, Tokyo was supposed to be when she was going to walk away from her LPGA career. But then, of course, when everything got moved back a year, then she got pregnant and had her son Luca, and then she played in Tokyo, but she was only 6 months postpartum, and she just didn't want everything to end that way because she didn't feel like she was ready for that moment. So the family had a conversation and decided that Paris would be the new goal, but it was tough for her just to get into this field, and the sacrifices that she made going over to play in Europe to do everything that she could, going back to LPGA Q school. You know, she came up clutch, and to watch her walk off, you know, with an eagle on the last hole. And she's in the field for the AIG Women's Open at the Old Course, but you won't see her there because this truly was her last round of competitive golf. And now she's going to go off and be a full-time mom. And I just applaud her because I thought it was a fantastic way to put a bow on your career.
I couldn't agree more, Beth Ann. Ron, I look back on the 2 weeks of war, but obviously focusing on the women's game there at Lake Golf. The Olympics, it's almost like the women's golf could take a victory lap in what this was. Looking at Rio and obviously Tokyo and 21 battling COVID, the vibe wasn't there. It clearly was here in Paris. What did you make of the few days that were with women's golf and the Olympics being represented there in Paris and how it all played out?
Yeah, you know, my off-the-podium moment for the game is the crowds, the galleries.
Yes.
They were massive for men's golf and nearly as large for women's golf. There were people who opposed bringing golf back into the game in the 2016, saying it's not a global sport. The game's proven over and over that it is. We've had 9 medals won by 6 different countries, 3 gold medals won by 3 different countries, and then the size of the galleries and the enthusiasm for the game showed this is a global game as a participatory game, as a competitive game, and as a spectator sport.
Absolutely, Ron. And one of my favorite storylines here was Xiu Lin, you know, a player who's definitely the best player on tour that hasn't won yet. And I think we would agree that if she had actually gotten across the finish line and won, say, the Portland Classic last year, which was one of her many top three finishes, that that wouldn't have resonated nearly as much in China as this bronze medal will. She'll be a hero when she goes home in golf circles. And even if she were to retire from the LPGA without a victory, this bronze medal will actually, I think, mean more to her than almost any win on the LPGA. So I really think that for a lot of players, you know, these Olympic Games are starting to take a really important place for them. And it's a great way for fans to get to know these players a little bit more, because I think nothing humanizes athletes like the Olympic Games. You can really feel connected to these players.
And China's attitude about sports is all about the big event. They're not looking to develop mass sports. They're looking to develop world-class athletes like Li Na in tennis, like Yao Ming in basketball, like Shan Shan Feng in golf. You know, for them, it's all about Olympic gold medals, Asian game gold medals. They don't want to build the sport from the ground up. They want to build it from the top down and have world-class athletes. She will be a hero when she goes home.
Bethan, do you think it's fair to say that, I mean, we saw a great reaction out of Scottie Scheffler when he won, he was very emotional. Do you think it's fair to say that the Olympics has meant more, visibly meant more to women golfers over the last three games because they're much more conscious of the limited opportunities to kind of sell their product versus what PGA Tour players have to deal with?
Well, 100%. And I think these players, you know, at the end of the day, you know, a lot of them aren't playing for a lot of money. Unless you're a really top player, you're going to get another job when you retire from the LPGA, right off into the sunset and not do anything anymore. So a lot of them aren't out there trying to get rich. They're out there trying to win and just for the fulfillment that brings them of this craft. And so I think, you know, going to Rio, going to Tokyo, and playing for nothing on the line but pride and country, you know, appeals to everyone on the LPGA. There was zero ego involved in that instance. In fact, we saw players skip major championships to prepare for this, Hugh Lynn being one of them.
Well, we just hit the turn here with the round table with Beth Ann and Ron. We're going to take a quick pause and we return. More round table, more golf today, more topics to discuss with the two when we return. Back here on Golf Today, the roundtable continues on. I'm Jordan, that's Ron, that's Beth Ann, and of course that's Eamon there. And staying with the Olympics here, and obviously celebrating all that Lydia Ko achieved, Beth Ann, I'd be remiss if not to mention one of the biggest stars and one of the faces of the sport, Nelly Korda. The inconsistencies continuing on. She did not medal over there in Paris. What do you make of where Nelly stands here today?
Well, I think what Nelly said, that she keeps compounding errors, is the, you know, hits the nail on the head, you know, that she keeps running up these big numbers. I think we were all holding our breath on that par three there thinking, oh no, we're going to see another 10 get quite that bad. But you know, she's still not what we saw in the beginning of the year, which was, of course, spectacular. And that's not to say that she can't get back there in a hurry and still have a lot of big moments for the year. So, you know, I don't think anybody's really worried about Nelly Korda, but it just really goes to show how tough it is to maintain that kind of brilliance for any stretch of time. And the way that she did it for pretty much the first half of the entire season is so incredible. And the LPGA is extremely deep.
Yeah, you know, I think that when you look at her, it's hard to get to the top of the mountain, but it's even harder to stay there. And I think it's something you got to figure out. You got to figure out how, and you got to learn how to juggle your time, all the other distractions and commitments that are coming your way. And I do think she's going to figure that out. She comes from a sporting family. She comes from an entire family. Everybody in the family's had to deal with this situation. They'll figure it out. I'm not overly worried about her.
Yeah. Maybe some people might be overly worried about what the LPGA Tour will look like without Lexi Thompson, as she's announced at some point retirement's going to happen for her as well as Lydia Ko. So, Beth Ann, as we try to imagine what that world looks like without these two mega stars, teenage phenoms who've only achieved throughout their career, what does that look like to you?
Well, these two are so unique in that they started winning on the tour at 15 and 16 years old, and we have really watched them grow up. So there are some special attachments that a lot of fans especially feel toward these players who've watched them, both of them, have some spectacular highs and some spectacular lows. So, you know, these are going to be big voids when they leave. And it very well could be that they both leave at the end of this season. And I think it's incumbent upon the rest of the tour, the players especially, to understand that, the gaps that are here with these stars that have, that, you know, we've been watching for more than a dozen years develop, and that it's going to leave a massive void on the tour. And I think players just need to understand the extra effort that needs to be made to take where they are, you know, even just even Anelli, everybody, top 10 players, everybody needs to put in a little bit of extra work, because I can tell you, as a member of the media covering the sport, those two generate a lot of page views, a lot of interest, and that you know, that's tough to lose.
Ron, on the subject of generational change, the U.S. Women's Amateur Final was played out at Southern Hills over the weekend when Rianne Malixi beat Asterisk Talley. Combined age of 32. So forget about collegians. It's now high schoolers battling it out for national titles. Does that give you some hope for the youth movement in women's golf?
It gives me both hope and concern at the same time. Look, there's no shortage of genius out there. A great talent keeps coming along. I remember in 1986 when Nicklaus wins the Masters at the age of 46, people saying, there's never going to be another golfer as dominant as Jack Nicklaus again. And 10 years later, we have Tiger Woods. Annika Sorenstam was followed by Lorraine Ochoa and Inbee Park. Genius always comes along. Sometimes we just have to be patient and wait. It'll eventually get there. Now, the concerning part of people achieving so much at such a young age, and I think we're seeing this more and more, I think when they start young, it's more and more likely to end young. You know, can you be out there 15, 16 years? Well, if you're out there at the age of 15 years later, you're only 30 years old. So that's the concern. And Beth Ann probably knows this better than me. Try to think of how many 40-year-olds are playing on the LPGA right now. We're not seeing people have those kind of careers that go into that stage of their life.
From young to old, specifically the old course, Beth Ann, that's coming up as the venue for the AIG Women's Open in a couple of weeks. And if any players are watching, if you find a scuffed Callaway left of the fifth fairway, you can mail it back to me if you would. But Bethan, the venues matter here, don't they? Specifically, this venue matters in terms of staging women's golf.
Oh, 100%. In terms of people getting excited, it doesn't get much better than that. And, you know, it's funny because... You know, I was so excited to have a grand farewell for Dame Laura Davies at the Old Course, and was so gutted to hear that she wasn't going to be playing, because that was supposed to be how she was going to say farewell to this remarkable LPGA career that should be in the Hall of Fame, obviously. but you know, as we mentioned earlier, so many iconic moments on the Old Course, so many people saying goodbye on the Old Course. You know, it's exactly what the LPGA needs. And I think there are going to be, I haven't counted, but I'm sure a large portion of the field will be seeing the Old Course for the very first time. And there are a lot of players on tour who you just don't know until you know. And even Laura Davies said that to me. She did not have the kind of appreciation that that this place deserves. It's now her favorite spot in the whole world, but that's certainly not how she thought of it before she went there for the first time in 2007.
You know, Rod, as we celebrate Lydia Ko qualifying, making that illustrious group, cementing her legacy, becoming a Hall of Famer with her 27th point at LA Golf, joining that Hall of Fame, she becomes the 35th person to do so in the LPGA Hall of Fame. That gets me thinking, are the qualifications too steep to make this, or is that the allure? Is that what makes it so impressive, is that it's darn hard to get there?
First off, I love a point system. I love having a very specific way to get in there. I'm on several Hall of Fame committees, and whenever I'm considering candidates, I make up my own point system. I want to figure out, how are we judging this person? But I do think they may have to look at lowering the threshold at a certain point, because I don't know, from what we're talking about before, I don't know if people are going to have the careers that are lengthy enough to get to that point total. And there are significant people. Christy Kerr didn't qualify. Meg Mallon, Dame Laura, as Beth Ann said. Those are people who didn't get there. But I've always liked it. I thought it was a high standard. It is the hardest Hall of Fame in all the sports to get into.
Yeah, I agree completely, Ron. I would also note that there are 35 players in the Hall of Fame, but but only 26 of them played their way in. And when you look at the fact that the LPGA is 75 years old and only 26 players actually played their way in, that's a really small number. Further, you have Sayre Pop, 2004 was when she got her 27th point. NB Park, 2015. Lydia Ko, 2024. That's way too spaced out. You know, we're looking at 10-year gaps here before we see the next player. And I just think when you have so many players that are in the World Golf Hall of Fame that are not in the LPGA Hall of Fame, that something's wrong with your system.
Couldn't agree. You know, Yanni Sin had probably had 18 or 19 points when she was 23 years old. And however many points she had then, she still has the same amount.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable. Without question, Ron, as you said, it is the toughest Hall of Fame to make it into, which makes it all the more impressive that Lydia Ko earned her 27th point and becomes the 35th to join the illustrious group. Beth Ann, Ron, thank you so much for the time. Look forward to hearing from you down the road.
Always a pleasure.
Well, it's time now for the road to the Solheim Cup, presented by Ping. It's been a career year for Nelly Korda. She joined Nancy Lopez and Annika Sörenstam as the only two players in the history of the LPGA Tour to win five consecutive starts. She also secured her second career major championship that came earlier this year at the Chevron Championship.
Nelly currently holds the top spot in the U.S. Solheim Cup team standings. The U.S. team will include the top seven players in these standings, the top two players in the Rolex Women's World Golf Rankings, not already eligible in three captains' picks. The team will be finalized on August 25th following the AIG Women's Open. On the European side, the team will include the top two players in these point standings, the top six players in the Rolex Women's World Golf Rankings, not already eligible, and four captains' picks. Golf Today rolls along after this short break. So to come on hour number two of Golf Today, we're bringing together another roundtable discussion with some of the top writers and voices in the game. What do Shane Ryan and Joel Beal think about the odd Monday finish in Greensboro? Well, you'll find out in just a little bit.
Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today. Eamon Lynch, Jordan Cornette in Synergy on 10s. We looked apart dressed as Chase Bankers today in blue.
Yeah, the wardrobe may look the same, but how would America ever tell us apart otherwise?
I have no idea.
Time now for a winning moment presented by Win Grips. And that's Aaron Rye, 29-year-old Englishman, who won his first victory in the PGA Tour yesterday by two strokes over Max Bracerman, the Wyndham Championship, with a final round of 64. Let's hear what the champ had to say.
It feels amazing. It truly is a dream come true. And so many people have played a huge role in me being at this point, from my mom, my dad, the rest of my family, Shabir Randeri, who's helped me since I was 8 years old, from my education to funding my golf and travels. Andy Proudman, Pierce Ward from Me and My Golf, Andrew Caldwell from Active Therapy. Is just, there's a huge team behind me being sat here, and I wouldn't be here without all of those guys. So yeah, just extremely happy and grateful to be here and to be surrounded by great people as well.
So many great finishes over the last couple of months for you. After the Zurich Classic, you were outside the top 100 in the FedEx Cup, and since then you've reeled off a bunch of top 10s, and you've now moved up to number 25 in the FedEx Cup standings entering the playoffs. How good does that feel, knowing that you've made such a big jump in the standings entering the playoffs and getting closer to a lot of the goals that I'm sure you've set for yourself?
Yeah, incredible. Very, very happy to have even been in the first playoff event going into next week before this week. To make that jump is a really great achievement. Obviously, a lot can change over the next 3 weeks for the better and also for the worst. So there's still a long way to go with the FedEx Cup playoffs, and which ultimately determines where we finish at the end of the year. But putting that to one side, as you said, for the last 4 months since the end of April, it's been a really good stretch of golf. Very proud and happy with the consistency more than anything else. Obviously amazing to be here and to win this week, but I'm almost just as proud of how consistent the last couple of months have been.
big picture, what's been the biggest difference in your game this season?
Statistically, probably my putting, certainly over the last couple of months. I recently started to work with John Graham, and he's helped me massively. My dad's helped me a lot as well with just visualizing the putts a little bit better, seeing them in a slightly better way. And that really, that really kind of helped over the last few weeks. I think my short game has also improved. My bunker play has improved. So it just feels like a real steady progression this year and another layer of kind of consistency from last year and the previous year.
What's the coolest thing for you about now being a PGA Tour winner?
I haven't really had much chance to think about that. I think just that statement alone of being a PGA Tour winner is truly a dream come true. To win on any professional golf tour is an incredible accomplishment. The PGA Tour is the pinnacle of golf, and it's amazing to be competing here week in, week out, but to have won a tournament is extremely special and something I'll always remember.
Here. So you didn't know that he had that Match had four putted. Did you know when he four putted a couple holes later? I mean, when did you know? Was there a time at all you knew on the course where you stood?
Not particularly. I did ask my caddy on the 18th tee what the situation was, and he knows me pretty well, and I trust whatever he says to me. And he just said focus on playing a good hole here. No, he didn't. But I also assumed that from him saying that, that's probably what it meant. And then when I walked up to the green, I did have a look to see the leaderboard. But until that stage, I wasn't aware of what the situation was.
When you finished, you called it a dream to win on the PGA Tour. When did that become a dream for you?
I used to watch a lot of golf, probably from the age of 10 years old, and a lot of it was majors. I really started to follow the PGA Tour probably into my teens, but at that time, it was so far away from me that it truly was a dream to even compete at that level. And then even after turning professional, I played a lot in Europe, and my focus was largely in Europe. And again, the PGA Tour wasn't really on my radar. Luckily, it kind of happened when maybe I was ready for it to happen. And then, being out here, I really appreciate how strong of a tour it is, how great of a tour it is, and just how high the level of golf is. So all the memories as a kid and growing up in my teens, mixed with actually understanding the reality of what the tour is like, just makes it that little bit more special.
Aaron Rye, our absolute winner. How about a moment for the winners who didn't win, but still won? Obviously, a big week on the PGA Tour from some of those who didn't take the top spot. Victor Perez, Davis Riley fighting for that 70th spot and to qualify for the FedEx, picking up on the par 4 13th. The approach from Victor Perez, pretty sublime there. Stuck it. He would go ahead and miss the birdie putt. He stays online and misses the playoff.
Here's Davis Riley, number 71 in the standings on that par 4 13th. A winner in the season earlier this year, makes the birdie, continues his push.
So Perez feeling that pressure, par 4 18th. His third shot here, greenside, and runs it just a tick past the hole here. Good pace, it's a little too much on it late. As it picks up steam, he knocked that in for par. Putting him in that spot as the winner, as he would qualify inside that top 70. Let's hear from the Bubble Boys after it all finished up yesterday.
Probably a little bit closer to like a chance of, you know, winning a tournament, because you're trying to really stretch as much as you can, whereas usually, you know, you're 25th place, you're just trying to, you know, improve, but it's not as do or die, which was a little bit more the case today, so we'll see how it plays out. I think the travel obviously is starting to kick in with, you know, coming from France last week with the jet lag and And the weather just being really hot this week has been really hard to stay hydrated and sleep. You know, I think the body struggles to wind down. And but I was trying to tell myself that if I'm tired, I'm sure everybody else is tired. You know, if I think the greens are getting bumpier, then I'm sure everybody thinks the greens are getting bumpier. I thought the pins were much harder this fourth round that they've been the first three, so I thought it was a little bit trickier to hold some putts and make some birdies, but yeah, we're definitely running low on energy.
I mean, I gave myself a chance to hit some really good shots coming down the stretch. I just couldn't make the putts. Probably the way I hung in there on a long day, and you know, on a week when I was feeling well under the weather and having to cap it off with a 36 day, it took about every ounce of energy I had in me, and yeah, I have a feeling it's not making one of those putts on the last couple is going to cost me, but I mean, you know, you could pinpoint it to 1,000 different shots throughout the season, so it's easy to pick the ones when they're there at the end. But yeah, it'll be pretty disappointing not to play in the playoffs, just, but you know, you're able to control your own destiny, and I wasn't able to do it. So you know, I only have myself to turn to and be looking forward to improving on some things and give it another go next season.
Were you looking at scenarios at all last night or figuring out where you were, or did you stay away from that?
No, I didn't really notice. I looked a couple times on the back nine. I kind of felt like I knew where I stood. I felt like it was going to be kind of, I knew, you know, Keith was kind of close. He needed like a top seven, six or something. And I know me and Victor were neck and neck, so I know I needed to probably beat him. And I saw that I think he posted eight. Didn't need to post an eight. I know I was at seven, so I knew I needed to. I knew exactly where I was. I'm coming in the last four or five holes, and that's where I just put my heart into it. And you know, unfortunately, I wasn't able to make the putts. And I had a feeling on 18 I had to make that putt. And if I made that putt, you know, I thought it was to maybe tie. I don't know what happens in that scenario if two players tie or what. But I knew that was probably the last chance. And yeah, I just misread it and hit a pretty good putt, just misread it.
You know, tough break there for Davis Riley, but as I look at this segment as winners who didn't win, that winner for me would have to be, coming off the weekend, Victor Perez. I mean, think about the week that was, you know, the first ceremonial first tee shot at Le Golf, the Frenchman in his native land, and all the electricity around that course throughout those few days. Look, he didn't medal. He finished fourth there. He called it the best and worst fourth place finish of his career. How does he bring that into this with all that's on the line with the FedEx Cup playoff and him needing to hold on to that 70th spot right there on the cusp? And it wasn't ideal for him coming in. He was battling illness earlier in the week, probably from the travel, maybe from the emotions, a lot on him coming from the Olympics. And he did what he needed to do, maybe benefited from golf being postponed on Thursday. He said he got some extra rest, but he delivered. And for Victor Perez to come out there with all that momentum from what happened over in Paris, to come out here, hold on to that 70th spot, to stick that putt on 18, it's massive. He's got a chance now to compete going in with some momentum.
He does, and I guess you could say that he was never going to face a bigger pressure situation last week in Greensboro than he did hitting that ceremonial tee shot in Paris. I would look to a winner who didn't win in Austin Eckroat, who's played very middling golf since he won the Cognizant Classic down at PGA National in March. But he entered this week 49th. In the FedEx Cup standings, which obviously is in no danger of dropping out of the top 70 who are going to make the playoffs. But at this point, unless you're the absolute cream of the crop at the top of the FedEx Cup standings, you are looking to give yourself oxygen. You're buying breathing room. And he did that. He went 64-67 in his 36 holes yesterday, birdie three of his last six holes, and that was enough for a solo sixth finish. And that's an enormous difference from that to being in, say, what would have been a seven-way tie for seventh place after that, and that put him up to 41st from 49th. So he's got a lot more breathing space heading into this week in Memphis, because only the top 50 are going to survive for the BMW Championship next week. And Max Gracerman did the same thing as well. He moved himself from 64th to 47th with his play yesterday, but he's not quite as comfortable this week trying to keep that place in the top 50.
And, of course, another guy we're not going to have a chance to see because he's an amateur, and that's Lou Clanton. I mean, what this young man's done, the 20-year-old junior out of Florida State, his third top 10 finish as he finished fifth at the Wyndham Championship over the weekend. Third top 10 finish as an amateur. Hasn't been done since Jack Nicklaus did it in 1961. And as you heard Luke say coming off of 18, he said, anytime you're mentioned with Jack Nicklaus, you're doing something great. But he doesn't have time to really process the whole thing because he's out there in Hazeltine trying to play in the U.S. Amateur. He had a tee time of 3:09 today. So after that marathon day, He's on a private plane headed up there, and he's going to try and go win another one.
And just in case Luke had any doubts in his mind, Jack Nicklaus also won that US amateur twice. So you're carry on the bar here.
It's never enough for you, huh?
I mean, it never is. It's always the next day.
Stick around when Golf Today returns. We're tackling some of the biggest stories in the game of golf. Shane Ryan, Joel Beal, they join us next for our roundtable. Make sure you stick around. Welcome back to Golf Today. Rewinding a sleep ago to Sunday, it was Aaron Rye who reached the winner's circle on the PGA Tour for the first time in his career. A Sunday 64 in Greensboro for Aaron as he looks ahead to the FedEx Cup playoffs with some juice.
Here is that upcoming FedEx Cup playoff schedule, starting this week at TPC Southwind in Memphis for the FedEx St. Jude Championship. Next week, the BMW Championship, and then the finale, the Tour Championship at East Lake in Atlanta, August 29th. Through September 1st, and here is the current top 10 standings, and no surprise, who's number one on that list? Scottie Scheffler. It's a pretty substantial lead over Xander Schauffele, Rory McIlroy in third place. And we're going to have another round table right now. We welcome in the Waldorf and Statler of Golf Digest, Shane Ryan and Joel Beal. And Shane, I want to start with the weekend down in Greensboro. You were on site there, and, you know, obviously Matt Kuchar is the focus of a lot of attention right now. And he's an easy target for trolls, has been for a number of years. He's perfectly within his rights to do what he did. Is he at fault?
Well, first, Eamon, I want to congratulate you on a timely reference with Waldorf and Stadler. I'm going to say something here. I'm going to say something here that people are not going to like. Matt Kuchar did nothing wrong. Now, I want to defend this position. Hear me out. First of all, did it look bad when he hit his drive and two players on the fairway? Sure. But as it turns out, he said today in the interview, he saw a pink shirt on the green. He thought it was Billy Horschel, which was in the group ahead of him. So he thought they were on the green. That's on somebody else. Somebody's got to tell him, you know, hey, listen, you can't hit yet. Nobody told him. He went up there. It was a confusing time. Matt Kuchar's not at fault for that. Then he gets in the fairway. And again, he's in a tough position. He is not obliged, right? He's not obliged to hit. In fact, the fact that he went and made par today was about an $80,000 difference for him. However, it goes further than that. This was an act of kindness to his fellow player, Greiserman. He didn't want him to take any critique. So he thought, well, there's no way Greiserman's going to hit because he had not yet seen Aaron Rye make his birdie. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give him a little bit of cover here. I'm going to say I'm not playing. That's going to let him say he's not playing, and nobody's going to get mad at him for delaying the tournament single-handedly. I don't use the word hero lightly, but that entire sequence was practically heroic for Matt Kuchar, and I'm sick of the trolls and the haters giving him a hard time.
I guess I'm a troll because, you know, on the surface, we can laugh at the latest oddity from a man whose career is filled with them. I think that explanation afterwards that he was doing it for Max, I don't think it did him any favors. But, I mean, to me, on a deeper level, this kind of epitomizes, like, the self-entitlement that we've seen that's been rampant in professional golf the past couple years. To me, you have a grounds crew that was working around the clock to get this course not only in playable condition after that storm came through on Thursday, but to make sure we could have a Sunday finish. And to have that triumph taken away by Kuchar, whose lone actions brought so many people back to the course today just so we could take TIO relief, make par. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize the point ramifications of this, but if we need to deputize rules and tour officials to maybe bring some common sense and take the ball off players' hands in situations like this, because he should have not been the one to put the kibosh on all that play yesterday.
Shane, I'm starting to feel like there's really two Americas with the stance on this one. Like, do people feel this way about Kuch or this way? We're seeing the division play out right in front of us. Some of this motivating factor is I try to discern exactly what was going on in the mind of Matt Kuchar, because I don't believe he was genuine in some of his responses because they were all across the board. But it makes me go back to, well, maybe one of those motivating factors was he wasn't happy with the officials that they were playing 36 holes on Sunday to determine this with all that was on the line. Shane, you were there. What was the sentiment from the field as they knew that this was going to be the approach? They're going to take 36 holes on Sunday, not bleed this into Monday to determine this thing.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think everybody understood why in a perfect world you want to finish on Sunday. And so I think they all got that. I think they, you know, it's going to be a tough day. You know, the temperature was maybe not as brutal as it usually is in August in North Carolina, but it wasn't nice. It was going to be hard. And, you know, some guys actually had to go more than 36 holes. But I think basically they understood. And I think most of them wanted to get out there. But I do want to point out that, you know, Joel Beal kind of getting mad at all the people having to come back. Potentially they got paid overtime. So that might be a little bit of an anti-labor stance coming from Mr. Beal. But no, look, I think all jokes aside, I think your point is right. It's hard to tell how sincere some of those comments were. The fact that he went up and hit his drive so quickly definitely made you think, oh, is he mad at people right now? Is he doing this because he's upset? But, you know, I think in the end, I do want to give Kuchar credit because I think he thought that Greizerman wasn't coming back. And so I don't think he was single-handedly making every single staff member come back on Monday. I think it was a very confusing moment. And, you know, maybe some of the negative PR in the past has been deserved. This one, I think, might be a little tough.
There you go, Joel. You've got the Bernie Sanders of golf media calling you out now for an anti-labor stance. I want to stick on this idea of the 36-hole Sunday. Do you think the tour, Joel, gets a bogey here? Because this was an event of some magnitude for the players involved, determining whether or not they were going to make the playoffs, in some cases maybe even keep a tour card for next year. Why the race against time? Why the insistence on trying to finish it in the dark?
TV, right? It's simply a TV matter. Coming back the next day, you're not going to have any ratings. And if people know the tournament's not going to end on Sunday, the impetus to watch is like going to drop. So it's a TV matter. I understand this is an important tournament. I think with the new fall structure that these guys aren't necessarily losing their cards at this tournament, maybe gives us a little bit more latitude. But yeah, it's not the greatest of look to kind of rush to get something in just for TV issues. And the only thing else I'll add is I don't know if Matt Kuchar's the pro labor epitome you want to pick there, Shane.
Hey, maybe that's a fair point. Okay, look, I'm just taking the situation as I see it. I will disagree with you on a serious note on finishing on Sunday. I think anytime you can do that, it's better. I think there is something neat about a late finish. Now, when it gets to the point of absurdity, that's a different question. But I truly don't think finishing out the tournament last night affected the outcome at all. And even though Kuchar stayed over an extra day, they did get it done on Sunday night. These guys have traveling to do. There's all that kind of stuff. I think anytime you have a chance, even if it's remote, to finish on Sunday night, you got to take it.
All right, so we're leading with Kuch, which says enough to me about the whole situation. When we should be talking about Shane, Aaron Rye and his performance here, winning his first tournament on tour, first championship on tour. What do you make of a guy who's been trending for these last few months in this direction to finally get that notch on his belt? What kind of force has he been as of late?
Yeah, he's been terrific. And I've been watching Aaron Rye for the last few weeks. You know, he's putting up some great results. I didn't realize until this past weekend what a pleasant voice he has. He has kind of this like sonorous, like slow voice. It's kind of like Adam Scott. I think you can make money by recording this guy's voice and giving it to people when they go to sleep. You know, it's just a pleasant thing. But no, he seems like a great guy. And the way he's been playing is phenomenal. Of course, he's got a couple wins on the DP World Tour, but this is the next level for him. Certainly well-deserved. And you have to applaud him. I think, as I wrote yesterday, a big part of the story is Greizerman kind of blowing it after making that eagle. And yet Aaron Rye was right there. He was right there. And then I've been going to Greensboro for a very long time. It is very rare, whether a guy's trying to win the tournament or keep his card or make the playoffs, it is very rare to see somebody make a clutch birdie on 18. That's a difficult hole. And what he did there in the darkness, I thought was phenomenal. One of the coolest finishes of the year.
Joel, since you've been branded as the evil capitalist in this conversation right now, I have this question for you. We're heading into these 3 weeks of the playoffs. By the time we get to Eastlake, the narrative really does become the money, because it is by far the most lucrative event in golf, and even more so this year than in past years. But we're in an era where the fans seem to have suggested that it's a bit of a turnoff, all of the cash talk all of the time. Do you think the tour has put itself in a little bit of a pickle of having a tournament that is so built up around the cash rewards at it when it's not really that appealing to fans, it seems?
Yeah, I think this was the case even before we saw the LIV schism happen in professional golf. People are tired of hearing about entitlement, about greed, about how much these guys are making. That's great that these guys are getting paid, but I don't know what the draw is for fans. And it honestly gives me more appreciation for what we saw this week in Greensboro, because Rye, he's kind of the antithesis of this, you know, spoiled, obtuse archetype of tour players. This is the guy who keeps the iron covers on his irons, because when he was coming up, his parents didn't have much money and basically had to spend outside their means just to give him proper equipment. So he keeps irons on, or he keeps covers on his irons to keep the club, not only keep the clubs in good shape, but to kind of remind himself of where he was coming from. And that's the type of guy we should be building around, not worrying about how much money these rich guys are going to make over these next 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'm with Joel this time. I rarely like to agree with Joel, but I think he nailed it. It is mystifying when you see these promos or the publicity where it's like, look how much this guy is making. And then look at Liv, look how much they're paying. Oh, we're going to raise our stakes. And I understand they have to have an arms race just to keep the good players, you know, on side so that you don't have everybody going to Liv. But it is not at all appealing to fans. It's not at all appealing to average people. It's curious at best, but it shouldn't be the focal point of your marketing scheme, in my opinion.
Joel, let's focus on one of those guys who can't be chasing the money right now, and it's the amateur Luke Clanton, who finished fifth over the weekend, his third top 10 finish as an amateur, something we hadn't seen since 1961 when Jack Nicklaus did it. Looking at Luke Clanton, is this a guy you can kind of feel like he might be the next big thing?
I mean, maybe, right? Or maybe this is just a really hot run. I mean, he's only 20 years old, and the graveyard of professional golf is just filled with the next best thing or the can't-miss prospect who ultimately missed. You know, I can't wait to see him come back out, especially in the fall. He's more than halfway to securing his tour card through the PGA Tour U ranking. I just would pump the brakes on putting any expectations on him. I mean, we even kind of saw that with Nick Dunlap this year, a guy who came out, won at Amex, and then really struggled until just a couple of weeks ago. So I think we just have to let these guys be kids for a little bit. I agree. It's been fantastic watching him, what he's done. It's going to be interesting to see what he does at Hazeltine this week. But I think we should just enjoy the ride at the moment rather than trying to forecast of where this guy could go.
I think we can all agree Luke Clanton is a special talent, but I agree with you there. A lot of agreement going on at the back end of the round table right now, which sounds to me, Shane and Joel, like a perfect place to pause. No more divisiveness when we return. More conversation with the round table here on Golf Today with Shane and Joel. That's next.
The first leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs gets underway in Memphis on Thursday with the FedEx St. Jude Championship. You can catch live first-round coverage right here on Golf Channel, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to resume our Golf Today roundtable with two of the best writers in the sport, Joel Beal and Shane Ryan. Shane, we're about to head into these final 3 weeks of the season where, you know, careers are made, checks are handed out. Is there anything that could potentially happen, any scenario in the next 3 weeks that you think changes a Player of the Year race, or is that still actually an open debate in your mind?
It's really tough. It's a good question. I kind of stuck my neck out a little bit. I was a bit of a giraffe after the Open Championship when I said that the way Schauffele played there and having captured his second major of the year, I actually liked him a little bit better than Scheffler for Player of the Year. Not everybody agreed with me there. I know Scheffler's one of the players. I know he's won a bunch. But then I flipped again. You know, as you know, Eamon, the sign of a brave, courageous, and wise man is to take new information and to somehow change your opinion sometimes. So when Scheffler won the gold medal, then I was back on Scheffler. I thought he was the Player of the Year. Now the question would be, could I flip again if Schauffele went on a crazy run and he won the FedEx Cup? Maybe. I think I'm really wishy-washy right now. I think my vote is still up in the air. I am the rare undecided voter here. I'm sort of the white whale.
You know, I guess if you can decouple the Olympics from Scheffler's resume, I think Xander has a shot. He would have to win the FedEx Cup as well as probably the St. Jude or BMW. Even if he does that, I just fall back on if you gave Xander the chance to trade his season with Scheffler's, I think Xander says no, but I definitely know Scheffler wouldn't trade his for anything. You know, 7 wins, winning the second Masters, first guy to defend the Players, affirmation Olympic triumph. I just still think Scheffler's way out in front.
Joel, you know, previous conversation, we talked about money driving the FedEx Cup playoff being a little bit off-putting. But throwing that to the side, to the fan that's maybe excited to watch the world's best in golf try and chase this playoff and chase this championship, what's of most intrigue to them, that a reason maybe why they should be watching?
I mean, this is the last time we're going to see the world's best really congregated in one space for the next couple months. So, it's been a really good PGA Tour season, honestly, the last 4 or 5 months especially. And getting a chance to see Scheffler before, you know, I don't think we're going to really see him in the fall, save for the President's Cup. I can't imagine Xander playing much either. Same with Rory. This is kind of your last chance to see all the big names. I think the fact that we have a couple bigger names also struggling right now, Hovland, Spieth, they need good weeks to just kind of crack through. I think that's another reason why to tune in the next couple weeks.
Shane, I want to take a look back at Paris with, obviously, Scottie Scheffler had a pretty emotional reaction, and Lydia Ko. Do you think we finally got a period where golf found its footing in the Olympics and people maybe started to understand that the gold medal isn't instead of or versus a major championship, but is actually additive, and it's more about golf claiming a place in this global community of sport instead of thinking of itself as a more insular country club endeavour?
Yeah, you know, I've always been sort of a hater of the Olympics just based on the format, because I didn't like that they were doing stroke play. I thought they should make it unique somehow, like the way rugby does rugby sevens. I thought they should do team match play. But there is a secret sauce here, which is that when you have something like 30 of the best players in the world and then 35 people who absolutely can't compete, you're going to have a really good leaderboard and a really exciting Sunday finish. And we've seen that now 3 times in a row. And so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it works. I really, really had a good time watching them both win. I thought it was an excellent, dramatic Sunday. So I think I'm being won over here, Eamon. The more we talk about different topics, like the bedrock under my feet is slipping away. I keep changing my mind. But Olympic golf, maybe it's working. Maybe it is. Maybe I still think they should do something kind of outside the box in L.A., but I can't argue with the results in Paris.
You really are something of a weather vane here, Shane. Joel, over the weekend, we finally realized where the Saudis draw the line at conduct unbecoming, and apparently it's over-the-counter decongestants, with Graham McDowell getting a suspension from LIV for use of Vicks when he was feeling sniffly in Nashville a few weeks ago. And in his statement, he said, unlike other tours, LIV enforces these regulations. Is that a fair job from McDowell about transparency when it comes to doping violations, or is that just him trying to cuddle up to Greg Norman because he signs the checks?
Yeah, I think the latter, because, you know, my initial reaction when I saw the news was, oh yeah, Graham McDowell plays on LIV. I haven't heard that name in a while. I mean, does he have a point? Yes, the tour probably needs a little bit more transparency with the suspensions, absolutely. But using a suspension for nasal spray as a soapbox to promote LIV while putting the rest of professional golf down, just take the loss, man. You know, maybe spend more time trying to beat half the field of these 54-player events than pounding your chest about how great LIV's anti-doping enforcement is.
Where are you on this one, Shane?
Well, Eamon, you know, there are certain things in life that are just intolerable, and you have to draw a line if you're going to have a moral code. No matter how much money you get, no matter, you know, what kind of fame or fortune, at some point you've got to say there are things in life that are wrong. And for me, that's using vapor rub without checking to see if there's banned substances. That is where we have to say enough is enough. Morally, we can't tolerate this. So I appreciate LIV having punished him for that. And I appreciate Graham McDowell for having owned up to it.
Well, then let's get back to sort of inside the ropes in golf that somebody's actually watching. Who do you actually think, Joel, I'll start with you. Who do you think needs the biggest week this week in Memphis? Because there are a couple of guys who aren't really lined up to be in the BMW Championship next week. Victor Hovland, the defending FedEx Cup champion for a start, and Jordan Spieth. They both have to make a move this week.
Yeah, as we mentioned both those names before, I think Hovland's the guy. This is someone who had that nice little comeback at Valhalla, the PGA Championship, but really hasn't been heard from since. All accounts, it was just kind of messing with his swing, messing with his instruction. Spieth, I think, as he showed last week, is just not healthy enough, at least in the right mindset either, that he can't trust his wrist enough to really go down the ball. Outside of that, I mean, I just keep looking at the top 10, seeing if anyone's going to really make a run at Scheffler. I guess Keegan Bradley would be another interesting name just because he's sneakily played well this year. He's got a chance to kind of make things uncomfortable by putting himself in a... If he makes the Tour Championship, I think he's got an outside shot to make the President's Cup. Then we get into this weird situation. I know he already said he's only going to, you know, he only wants to automatically qualify for the Ryder Cup. He doesn't want to pick himself. But if he puts himself in these positions to start competing a little bit more, all of a sudden, this could be a little bit of a situation for Team USA going forward.
Yeah, I would agree with Joel. I think, you know, I'm always looking at President's Cup at this time of year, too, and obviously Ryder Cup when it's a Ryder Cup year. Looking at the standings now, absolutely Spieth, absolutely Victor Hovland. I think you're looking at marginal guys. Somebody like, you know, you were talking about him earlier, Eamon. We saw someone like Austin Eckroat, someone like Harris English or Jake Knapp, can any of these guys go from somebody that we're like, yeah, they've had a pretty good year, they've done pretty well, could they put together just a great stretch here, get on the President's Cup team, and could it change their career in some way? I think in some ways that's the most interesting part of the FedEx Cup playoffs. I think you take it for granted somebody like Scheffler or Shoffley is going to win, but who are the guys who are going to make this huge, huge leap here over the next 3 weeks, and for which of them is it going to kind of alter, you know, what we think of them and the trajectory of their whole career moving forward?
Much like the tournament officials working on a Monday in Greensboro, so too are Shane and Joel. We appreciate the time, guys.
Thank you very much.
Working on a Monday because Matt Kuchar wanted them to go. I digress. Some history made over the weekend in the U.S. Women's Am. When Golf Today returns, we got the unique story of our latest national champion. Make sure you stay tuned.